Okay, hi everybody, and welcome to our 47th program in the Treatise on White Magic. We're working in the rules for the mental plane. We have, we're quite a bit of the way through rule number five, and we're on the 12th program for this fifth rule, and then there will be the sixth rule that will complete the rules for the mental plane. We're about a little more than a third way through the book. It's just the beginning, of course. Now, we've been talking about the numbers of the petals on the way up to the Ajna Center and found that there are 48 of these petals. They're not really petal, of course. It's a way of symbolizing or expression, an expression of force and its apparent effect in matter. And so we continue here. The five centers with their 48 petals are synthesized, therefore, into the two-petaled lotus, and then we have 48 plus 2 equals 50. Now, that's a very interesting number, because in a way, the number of the perfected personality, 50, the 5, 5 for the number of man, and the 10 that is of perfection. Now, much will depend on how we count, how we arrive at that number 5. You know, because 50 equals 5 in the numerological way of summing. We have the dense physical body on the three lower subplanes. We have the etheric body on the four higher subplanes of the systemic physical plane. We have the astral body, and we have the lower mental body. Those are four. And their synthesis from a center on the fourth subplane of the mental plane makes 5. That's one way of looking at it. And here we see 1, the dense physical body, 2, 3, 4. And here is the mental unit around which the personality constellates itself. So from a certain perspective, its number is 5. I guess you could consider the etheric physical body as 1, the astral body as 2, and the mental body as 3, and synthesize the 3 of those, mind, emotions, and body, as a 4. That's another way of doing it. But anyway, the 10 is the perfection, and 5 is half of that. So this is one way of looking at those 48 petals, because there are 48 petals up to and through the throat center, plus the 2. Now, there are other ways of considering this. Symbolically also, if the sum total of the 48 petals of the five centers is added to the 96 petals of the center between the eyebrows, the number 144 appears. Now, we know about this number 144 because it is taken literally by many of those in the Christian faith, and this is called the number, well, let's make it number of the saved. Well, if we add three ciphers to it, 144,000. So he goes on and says, the number signifies the completed work of the 12 creative hierarchies, 12 times 12, okay, and we're not considering any kind of isolated 13th hierarchy, which is a kind of an ill omen that comes from isolating the lower mental field as a sphere of expression for those on the left-hand path. You know, the what is it, the story about the Sleeping Beauty and the 12 good fairies who were invited and the one who was evil and was not invited but crashed the party. You know how it goes. Anyway, 12 times 12, that's very interesting. And that also equals 144. And thus the bringing together of the subjective, okay, very good. Here we come back, I hope. Yeah, the bringing together of the subjective soul and the objective body in perfect union and at one-ment. So we can say under the number 144 or 12 times 12. Now to these figures, 144, add that of the number 1000, the number of the petals in the lotus of the head center. Now this is still symbolic, we can say, because it's not really the 1,000-petaled lotus. It's, as far as I can tell at the moment, the 972-petaled lotus, 960 plus 12, but it's symbolically referred to as the 1,000-petaled lotus. So the number of petals in the lotus of the head center, and you have the number of the saved in the book of Revelation. Not Revelations, but Revelation. I guess that was one of the errors that was always creeping into these books. It's there's no plural there. The 144,000 who can stand before God for the three ciphers which are found indicate the personality and its three vehicles. So we have the fulfillment of the creative hierarchies and the consummation of the personality development. The fulfillment of the three of the, okay, let's see, right here. This is what we have to have. The fulfillment of the three vehicles, of the, let's just say, of the 12 creative hierarchies, CHS, let's see if I have that. No, I don't. CHRS, okay, I'll just spell it out. Okay, the fulfillment of the three creative, of the 12 creative hierarchies and the perfected personality, indicated by the three ciphers. So they can stand before God because they are perfected. So they are, in that respect, they are saved from the immersion of consciousness in the lower levels and the entrapment of consciousness in those levels. That's one of the things that salvation can mean. It doesn't just mean going to a certain environment called heaven and staying there. Okay. So they can stand before God. Let's see. Okay. Before God. For the three ciphers which are found indicate the personality. When man has completed within himself the great work, and in a way man is the great work, when the number 144,000 is seen as symbolizing his point of attainment, then he can stand before God, standing now not only before the angel of the presence, but before the presence itself. It's the, we can say, the angel of the presence introduces man to his monad, to Shambhala, to Sanat Kumara earlier than would otherwise have been possible. So we can see the deep esotericism hidden in these numbers. And of course, I've often thought it's a good talking point to certain people who take these numbers literally as indicating that many people to be saved. Of course, it's far too few, so I don't know how they deal with that, because there are, let's say, millions and millions of believers in the Christian faith, and one believing and accepting Jesus, let us say, is to be numbered among the saved, so far more than 144,000. But this seems to me a bridge which can be used to transfer into a more occult worldview. And I always like to include the word spiritually occult, because it somehow it raises the vibratory level of that word, which has often been associated with some pretty dreadful and low practices. Now, when we are speaking of the completed work of 12 creative hierarchies, we have to remember how very high in the scheme of things are the upper hierarchies, the higher hierarchies. If I could go here, let us say, and remind us of an astonishing thought, I think, the very higher hierarchies on the still on the cosmic physical plane are perhaps even above the rank of the solar angels. And these triple flowers, these burning suns of desire, these divine lives, they are far indeed ahead of human development. Perhaps it's possible for the monad to at least come in contact with the gifts of these hierarchies through development within the spiritual triad, let us say, here for the triple flowers, through contact with and with the monad, and becoming eventually a sixth degree initiate, coming in touch with the gifts of the divine builders, the burning sons of desire, and perhaps a great being like the Christ or a being like the Buddha, who is liberated onto the seventh plane or the sea of fire, is coming at least in touch, effectively in touch, with these divine lives. So it would be the work of these creative hierarchies as related to the possible progress of man, but not, I think, the coming into expression of man as a being of equal rank to these higher hierarchies. The true place for the solar angels is a question. Now, here they are placed upon the Buddhic plane, and they invest a portion of themselves onto the higher mental plane, here plane number 5, and that portion, I think, is called the angel of the presence, introducing the man at length when he is ready, or making way for him, or earlier than would have been possible, presenting him to his own monad, or making it possible for the immersed consciousness of the man, which is soul infused, to begin relating to his own monadic nature, however slightly. So really what's going on these three higher planes, and even on the Buddhic plane, these vibratory levels are the area of focus of the presence and the consciousness of the masters themselves. So we're not really going to be in a position to know much more than that, and a little bit about the planetary energies which are available there, and the kind of force or shaktis that are available. Yeah, this is a fascinating chart, and I think it's kind of a collection of many charts with, to which the Tibetan gave his sanction. The solar angels, remember, have already been, apparently, to the cosmic astral plane, whereon the path to Sirius is found, It certainly is found there now. And the question is when in the previous solar system they journeyed as graduate human beings to Sirius, did they have to enter the cosmic astral plane? I think the answer is yes, and they've fallen into the cosmic physical plane again out of will and sacrifice. And they are not confined to the cosmic physical plane except by their own choice. So they would be initiates of very high degree. And then what about all these other initiates, which are probably some of them deva hierarchies of equal rank to the human? What is their true status? So things are very high here on the higher levels of the cosmic physical plane. And the human master is really master of the lower 18 or perhaps 21 subplanes, especially the lower 18 subplanes, and is only becoming familiar with the conditions, the vibratory conditions and the possibilities, the Shakti possibilities and so forth, found upon the highest of these subplanes. There's a lot to be filled out, and I'm sure that Master DK will give us what he can, which will be appropriate to our level of evolution. Right now, we have a lot of work to do on much lower levels. All right. Well, I wonder, can we move on to the next section? There are about 11 pages left here. We're on page 2000 right now. Okay, 200, and then actually in the book it will be until the end of page 208. So I don't think we can finish this in this section unless we make a longer program, which the transcribers don't like me to do. And anyway, I have a webinar coming up. Let's just see how far we can get in this process. Now, so we deal now with the moving from this fascinating numerology where every one of these divine numbers really reveals something about the unfoldment of our energy system and our consciousness. And we don't know exactly whether etheric unfoldments are equaled by the astral unfoldments in the etheric part of the astral plane, or whether the unfoldments on the lower part of the mental plane equal such, in other words, on the fourth level, equal such unfoldments on the astral plane on the fourth level and the etheric plane on the fourth level. All of that has yet to be discussed. But suffice it to say that, like a lotus, we are unfolding after many, many lives, and a consciousness of that which is forever present but undetected begins to dawn upon us. Now, this particular subject, the awakening of the senses, of course, is a great lure to people who still identified as personalities want rapid progress for their personality, and the result is oftentimes disaster. The same kind of effect as heavy drugs could cause ripping the inner fabric and requiring lives to rebuild it. The question now arises, says DK, how can this awakening and this coordination be brought about? So there's the stimulation of the center coming into greater livingness, but then there's also the mutual adjustment between centers which are to be related to each other. And that no doubt there's some kind of divine proportion that is desirable in the case of every individual, and many people are in transition in working out that particular proportion between, let us say, the amount of heart center unfoldment compared to the amount of solar plexus unfoldment, the amount of throat center unfoldment compared to the amount of sacral center unfoldment, etc. What steps must be taken in order to produce this vitalization and the eventual synthetic activity of the three centers? Now, I suppose we're dealing especially with the head center, the heart center, and the throat center. Now, these are the three centers that the three major monadic rays are principally focused within. So the first ray, obviously, in the head center, the second ray in the heart center, and the third ray, monadic type, in the throat center. There are seven types of monads, but I'm talking about the ultimate three. Faced with these questions, the true teacher finds a difficulty. It is not easy to make clear the esoteric and paralleling activities which are the result of character building. Now, you know, I guess many students find perhaps this a boring subject. Is this a boring subject to us? It is a necessary subject, and we are guarded against a unwholesome, unholy veering off towards the left in the past and form by taking into consideration the importance of character building. So we have to, you know, really build into ourselves as soul-infusing personalities the good, the beautiful, and the true, to whatever extent we can, remembering that these are the names of great beings, he tells us. And that is, I think, an astonishing idea, the names of great beings. So oft the aspirant is anxious to be told some new thing, and when he is told some old truth, so old and so familiar that it fails to call forth a registering response, he feels that the teacher has failed him, and so succumbs to the sense of futility and depression, you know, like, let's just say, he's not getting anywhere. That's the sense that may come about. Am I making progress? The student asks himself. However, this must be met and the question must be answered. I will state, therefore, the necessary requirements as succinctly as possible. I mean, you can imagine the volume, is there such a word as voluminosity related to volume? The voluminosity of Master DK's learning and how, given time, space constraints, it would be impossible for him to offer to us all that he knows, and certainly unwise. Not only could we not assimilate it, but it would not be appropriate. So yes, so much time in which to work. He probably knew, or he hints that he knew later, that Alice Bailey would have 30 years of work with him before it was necessary for her to pass on. And he had to complete minimally certain kinds of books and presentations during that period. So he can't tell everything. Hence the question of succinctness. And we sometimes wonder when he says he's being succinct, he's presenting a lot of information, but for him, it is succinctness. Okay, so he'll state the necessary requirements as succinctly as possible, giving them in their sequential order and according to their importance from the standpoint of the average aspirant. He's always speaking to the average aspirant, which he says we are, and he says if you don't think you're that, you're in the danger of pride and thinking of yourself as special, and the separation enters in. And that is a retardation. Let us then enumerate them in tabulated form, and then we will deal briefly with each point. So, character building, the first and essential requisite, and the great law of karma is supposed to help establish a basic foundation of good character. The law of karma. Okay. Well, I'm going to... Sorry. I'm going to do it. Law of karma. L-O-K. Okay, we already have it. So the law of karma is to establish a basic foundation of good character. At least energies will not be misused. Then comes the question of right motive. There, it all boils down to the right-hand path and the left-hand path. So a motive which sets a person on the right-hand path, a vision which animates and inspires, that vision being one of group life and eventual realized oneness and complete cooperation with the divine plan and the eventual registration of the divine purpose. These things have to be well established in the individual. Service. Okay. And he actually tells us there is a way in which the activity of service is of greater value and more revelatory than even meditation. And that may surprise some, but it certainly does open the heart center, and the heart is the great synthesis and leads towards inclusion and identification. It breaks down barriers. And our whole problem with illusion is that we are confined in our consciousness to a type of perception which still perceives barriers and isolated fragments which are not integrated or made whole. Then meditation, then a technical study of the science of the centers, which he's been giving us somewhat already. Breathing exercises come later and under, under wise supervision. And then learning the technique of the will. What does he mean by that? He certainly has often said, we don't know, we as aspiring disciples, or aspiring disciples in training, don't know much about the will at all. The development of the power to employ time, and I would say, and thus master the chaos of Maya. Mastering the chaos of Maya, remembering, remembering that time is of the essence. It's a profound phrase, and we have to see what it means. And finally, and only finally, and after all of this has been put into place, which so many unschooled students do not realize, then the arousing of the Kundalini fire. Now, you know how often it is that filled with wrong motive and not having developed good character and not having served and even not having meditated and hardly knowing what their centers is all about, they will to raise the Kundalini fire with disastrous results. All right. You know, I always wonder where I've started in these things. Page 199. Okay, good. So this lays out our little curriculum. The last and ninth point will not be considered at this stage of our training, and the reason is obvious. I guess if we don't know what that reason is, you know, we're not initiates of the third to fifth degree, and the deliberate arousing via the Ajna center of the Kundalini fire is not on our immediately necessary agenda. We have a lot more to take care of and to clean up. Most aspirants are at the stage of the fourth, third, and fourth points. And you've seen in the Arcane School and in the work of Alice Bailey this very strong emphasis on points number 3 and 4, meditation and service, and are just beginning to work at the 5th and 6th. He's provided a lot about the centers and the breathing. Occasionally, a breathing exercise is offered with certain counts for the inhalation, retention, exhalation, retention, impression. But it's the thoughts we think while we're doing it that are important, and not just the manipulation of the air currents and the counting of numbers. So the thoughts of being entertained are that which is of importance in the breathing exercises. So stay to the 3rd and 4th point, and, you know, just to remind ourselves, service. Come on now. Service and meditation, and are just beginning to work with the 5th and 6th, the centers and breathing exercises. Let us touch briefly upon each of these necessary steps, and let me enjoin upon you the need there is to realize in some measure the responsibility entailed by knowledge. You know, we go on accumulating knowledge and find that we lay up a karmic debt for so doing if we have not used the knowledge properly or wisely. Do you appreciate the fact that if you were making full use of each piece of information given in the course of training and making it a fact in your experience and were living it out in your daily life, the teaching so steadily imparted, living out in your daily life, the teaching so steadily imparted, you would be standing ere now before the portal of initiation. So what's the principle involved here? Application of knowledge leads to initiation. But apparently, you know, the hint is very strong here in this sentence that we're receiving a lot of knowledge and we're not applying what we know. We're like a, you know, starving person who's just eating more and more and not assimilating it, and it leads to a kind of congestion and sickness, and it doesn't really help the system. Do you realize that truth has to be wrought out in the texture of daily living before new truth can be safely imparted? So now, facing the year 2025 and the offering of the new dispensation, installment, we have to ask just how much of the great teaching given in installment 2 have we assimilated and applied. And I think a sober and sobering recollection of the degree to which we have successfully applied what we've been taught could be a little disappointing to us. I mean, you know, our heads are filled with this wonderful knowledge, and the question is, accordingly, how do we live? With good character, with right motive? Are we really serving? How's our meditation depth and its rhythm? You know, even that type of foundation up through number 4, we could question ourselves. So, he is offering us here the road of practicality. And this is, of course, in one way, a very practical foundational book, giving the basics of discipleship and, as he said at some point, the control of the astral nature, the versatile, fluid astral nature. it's a practical book. Other parts of it cannot be yet fully understood because there are certain phrases and thoughts and mantras and so forth, which are deliberately withheld until we know what we're doing with them and can be trusted. Okay, so let's just look at this a little bit. The review of these 9 points, interestingly enough, of course, 9 is always considered the number of completion before a new cycle is undertaken. So, character building. These 9 points are to be studied from their force aspect and not from their ethical or spiritual import. Now, obviously, when we build right character, we treat the energy system in a way which hastens its integration. We treat the energy system in a way which facilitates its integration and right use. So not so much from you should do that, you shouldn't do this, not from the point of view only of right behavior, let's say, and what consciousness will arise, but from how force is to be manipulated, or what a particular phase does with regard to the manipulation of force, how force within the system is to be manipulated. It is the, quote, world of force into which the initiate enters, and it is the training he receives as an aspirant that makes such a step possible. So we are, you know, and let's just say that Master DK's ashram is a training ashram. Maybe they all are in a way, but he is specifically to train aspirants for initiation, the first two initiations mostly, and occasionally the third initiation. Each of us enters life with a certain equipment, the product of past lives, of endeavor and experience. And I suppose a little analysis of the condition in which our energy system was found in the earlier part of our life will tell us something about the legacy we have carried over. And then now later in life, we can evaluate and see whether there have been changes and whether those changes have been for the better towards the introduction of soul energy and the integration and harmonization of the various energy flows within our energy system. So the past has given us what we're born with. That equipment has in it certain deficiencies or lacks and is seldom of a balanced nature. I guess if we're honest about this, I know I would. I think I entered, you know, life in some kind of unbalanced nature, you know, maybe too much mentality, or certainly too much nervous chaos, you know, too much Aquarius doing that. And that, all that is settled down through the lessons of life. One man is too mental, another is too psychic. Notice the two. It's a question of exaggeration and minimization, over and over and under emphasis. Excuse me. Minimization. Okay, over and under emphasis. Excuse me. A third is primarily physical, and still another is too mystical. We can say, you know, mystical and impractical and longing for a different state than that into which he or she has been born. One man is sensitive, irritable, and impressionable. You know, you can always almost feel the different planets and signs of the zodiac leading towards these states. You know, the Neptunian mystical state and the Mercurian mental state, and the psychism of Neptune, perhaps, and Vulcan and Saturn inclining towards physicality and so forth. Anyway, another is the reverse of these qualities. One person is centered in his animal nature, so too much Mars, or is strictly material in his outlook on life, Mars and Saturn, and of course the constellations associated with them, whilst another is visionary, Jupiter, Neptune, and free from the sins of the flesh, but maybe not fulfilling his obligation to the physical form of humanity. So let's just say there are so many imbalances. And later in life, we have to assess what they are and correct them. Well, not too late. You know, if you get to be my age or the age of some of my associates in your 60s and 70s, so forth, you better have done some work on this. But, you know, by the time we're in our 20s or early 30s, we certainly should get a clear idea of how the balance or imbalance of our energies are impelling our life process in positive or negative directions. The diversities among men are innumerable. So that's the study of character, right? But in each life, there is a predominant trend towards which all of his energies naturally turn, a predominating trend. You know, the skandhas, as they're called, are tendencies which are carryovers, we might say. The skandhas. Okay, where am I here? I'm always making little mistakes here. The skandhas are the tendencies carried over and perpetuating themselves through repetition, unless we can actually correct the ones that need correcting. Perhaps he is swayed strongly by his physical forces and lives consequently the life of an animal. One thinks of Shakespeare's perspective on this in The Tempest, where Caliban was the animal man in that play, and others were more Davic, like Ariel, you know. Or he is swayed by astral energy and lives a potently emotional and psychic life, and this is what we call, you know, the Atlantean consciousness, which is predominant in humanity at this time. Still, we have this hangover from Atlantis, and although the number of mentally focused people is growing, it's still a minority. So many people can be reached primarily through their solar plexus and through fear, acquisition, maybe idealism. So that is a prevalent approach. Perhaps like so many, he is swayed by three types of energy: physical, emotional, and an occasional flow of soul energy, because there is a connection between the soul and the astral body, particularly monad mind, soul, astral body, personality, dense, etheric physical body. The point to be remembered is that the bodies in which we as souls are functioning constitute primarily energy bodies. So let's just say, you know, we all have a different energy condition. And we must be aware of it in a clear and detached manner. Now, you know, as disciples, we do want to separate ourselves from emotional reaction to that which we find. You know, it's easy to get upset about the condition one is in and to have a kind of a esoteric inferiority complex about what it is possible for one to accomplish. Those kinds of emotional reactions, either depression or some kind of overenthusiasm or exaltation, they are both undesirable if they last too long, if perpetuated. So anyway, these vehicles, they are atomic in nature. They are composed of energy units, atoms in a state of constant flux and movement, and find their place in an environment of a similar nature. Acting as the positive nucleus in these energy bodies, and at present, in the majority of cases, relatively static, is the soul. So, DK is trying to awaken the soul in his readers so that we may truly become the soul-infused human being. But we know that for the majority of people, they may be oriented toward heaven, but they're not oriented towards the soul as the center of their identity on a higher plane. There's still a duality there. There's I, who I am, and then maybe there's something, a soul, that I have and am not wisely identified with. So occultism corrects this dualistic misapprehension and stresses our own identity as a developing soul and one that has great potential before it, not simply a single life of development followed by a harsh judgment. So this soul, it exerts as little, as yet, little pressure upon its sheaths, that exertion of pressure. This exertion would be Vulcanian. You know, let's call it the planet of pressure. Vulcanian, let's see if we can make that added to the dictionary, and identifies itself with them, which is wrong identification, thus temporarily negating its own intrinsic life. This is, now we might say that esoterically, this is the extroverted soul. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're happy and joyous and outgoing and so forth. In your personality nature, you know, let's say a lot of Jupiter making you an extrovert, it has to do with the direction in which your consciousness is oriented. Does it truly realize its own center, or is it engaged identificatorily, can I use such a word, invested in its own perceptions, in the not-self. It turns out the not-self are really eventually self-perceptions. It's all the self. But are we invested in the external, or are we turning inward and finding that indeed we have and are a soul at the center of all of this personality experience? Right, we're dealing with character building. The day comes, however, when the soul awakens to the need of dominating the situation and of asserting its own authority. And we're speaking of, this is more the the soul in incarnation than it is the soul on its own plane. Then the man, spasmodically at the beginning, you know, when we feel like it, you know, as it is said, when he feels like it, takes stock of the situation. He has to discover first which type of energy predominates and is the motivating force in his daily experience, let's just say, hence the study of astrology and the rays. And having discovered this, he begins to reorganize, to reorient, and to rebuild his bodies. Because they are in a certain condition, and he realizes that that condition is relatively undesirable compared to what he might accomplish spiritually if these vehicles of expression were in better, more soul-aligned condition. So the whole of this teaching about character building can be summed up in the two words, vice and virtue. Now, you know, vir has to do with life, virility, vitality, strength of radiation, and so forth. And when we come to a word like vice, it suggests being held in a grip, confined and imprisoned within a small area, when we could, in fact, break through and out of that area and experience a much wider life. You know, the life more abundant is coming, but it's not coming for those who are, as the old television program used to say, caught in the jaws of the vice. I guess I was just a kid, and I used to see that on TV, but it made an impression upon me. When you cannot be free from your own low desires, you are living the world of vice, and you are caught in the world of vice. Now, you know, hopefully we're learning how to disengage through understanding more what we really are and identifying as souls rather than through desire, identifying as the vehicles. It's quite simple. As we describe it, it's just maybe difficult to do. Vice is the energy of the sheaths, individual or synthesized as the personality, and controls the life activities and subordinates the soul to the sheaths and to the impulses and tendencies of the lower self. Now, you know, it's interesting because the Black Lodge seeks to promote vice in people. It seeks to over-stimulate the energies of the sheaths and make man a captive, as they are, of a great material physical plane, deva, I guess of huge proportions, and from which they cannot escape. So they promote that kind of overstimulation of the elemental lives and the elementals in our personality nature, whether physical, emotional, or lower mental. So when we find ourselves in a condition of overstimulation in any of these vehicles, such that that vehicle is taking the majority of our attention, it's not necessarily a sign of livingness. Livingness is a different thing. And it's coming from the higher aspects of our nature. Now, what about virtue, which is really associated with strength, spiritual strength, especially moral strength? It is the calling in of new energies and of a new vibratory rhythm so that the soul becomes the positive controlling factor and the soul forces supersede those of the bodies. There's going to be a clash, right? I mean, obviously between vice and virtue, and we human beings live in a kingdom which is characterized by the fourth ray, and the warfare between vice and virtue is ongoing. It's like a warfare between the moon and the sun. with the moon representing the vehicles and the elementals, and the sun representing the soul and the higher spiritual tendencies. So this process, get my hair on my eyes here so I can see what's going on. This process is that of character building. Let me illustrate. I'm amazed. You know, it's been a while since I've read this book. Kind of concentrating, you know, on big abstract things that are just impossible to fulfill. But this is the rock bottom, the foundation of everything we're doing, and I'm very happy to be reminded of these things to keep everything in proportion. So let me illustrate, says the Tibetan. A man is the victim of an irritable and nervous disposition. We say to him that he needs to be calm and peaceful and to cultivate detachment and so gain control of himself. You know, how many times have we said, look, get a hold of yourself here. Just calm down. Don't fly off the handle at every opportunity. And, you know, just use quietness. We teach him that in the place of a cross disposition, there should be sweetness and calm. You know, it's kind of a Venus-Mars situation. Mars, the planet of irritability, chafing, friction, overreactivity. It's a non-sacred planet, and its energies and forces are often used in that way. And Venus, a very sacred planet, and associated with all sweet things, agreeable, harmonious things, and with a general placidity and calmness. Now, you really get to the nature of the planet Venus. There's quite a bit of storming going on up there and totally inhospitable conditions as far as a human being is concerned. But we're speaking here of the metaphysics of the planet Venus. Now, that sounds like a platitude, he says, and most uninteresting. Yet what is really being stated is that in place of the restless, self-centered emotional nature and the activity of the solar plexus center, carrying the powerful forces of the astral plane, there should be imposed a steady, detached, and harmonizing rhythm of the soul, the self. So it's an energy substitution that is being requested. All of us have to learn how to, it's really hard, change our energy. I remember when I was at the United Nations Jeddah, excuse me, Krishnamurti was being feted, you might say, as the world teacher. He was a great teacher. And basically, he was asked by the Robert Mueller, I forget his title, but it was a high-ranking title in the United Nations. What should we do, Mr. Krishnamurti? What do you advise to us? And, of course, there was a pause, and then this big voice coming out of a small man said, change. Well, that made a first-rate impact on me, I'll tell you. And to change one's energies, we realize, is desirable, but we don't oftentimes know how. Now, look what I'm going to do here, because I have a webinar coming up. I'm going to make this an hour and a half program instead of trying to do two programs and taking the time in between. So we'll go on now for another half hour, roughly or so. So to change the energies of Mars as they affect us, or our response to the Martian energy, to a utilization and response to the Venusian energy, which is the energy of the solar angel and the growing soul nature, and soul realization is all correlated with the planet Venus, or at least Venus is a very important planetary correlate. Jupiter is up there too. So this work of imposing A higher vibration on the lower is character building. All right, well, you know, that's a great definition. And I'm just going to kind of enlarge it because it's so good. This work of imposing a higher vibration on the lower is character building. The first prerequisite upon the path of probation, which we do know does begin before the first initiation can be taken, and signals work in the unfoldment of the latter part of the fifth petal of the egoic lotus. As I've said before, when that fifth petal is completely unfolded, excuse me, I wasn't, got unplugged. When that fifth petal is completely unfolded, we have the initiate of the first degree. So this is right now the first prerequisite upon the path of probation. Some people say probation lasts all the way past the first initiation until one becomes truly an accepted disciple, at least midway between the first and second initiation. But there is certainly a beginning made on the probationary path before it is possible to take the first initiation because of the kind of tests one submits oneself to, the kind of training one undergoes. On reading this, the earnest student can begin to sum up his energy assets. He can tabulate the forces which he feels control his life, and thus arrive at a reasonable and truthful understanding of the forces which require to be subordinated and those which require to be strengthened. You know, too much of this and too little of that. And DK has told us that our virtues are often the cause of our vices. We just exaggerate and overemphasize certain virtues and create an imbalanced situation. So it's often where we feel we are strongest that some type of force radiation is coming out that is actually weakening our relationships with the environment, and is not these radiations are not a sign of good character at all. So we have to be careful where pride may come into the picture, and where we say, "Oh, I'm really good at this," and within it may be hiding a kind of vice, a kind of attachment, a kind of circumscription, which is holding us in lower consciousness and in lower energy effectiveness. Then, in the light of true knowledge, let him go forward upon the path of his destiny. So, you know, if I were teaching a class on white magic, and once again I will be pretty soon, I think, I would really have people stop here and sum up their energy assets and their liabilities, as we all would do, and see what has to be added, strengthened, what has to be controlled and regulated. There's our star Regulus up there in Leo, which is so important for the first initiation, bringing certain energies into law and regulation, under law and under regulation, is a very practical thing, isn't it? And it doesn't just leave us. You know, we can say, oh, well, now I'm an initiate of this degree or that degree, so I've left character building behind. But I'm sure that when facing the demands of the fourth initiation, let us say, very solid sacrificial character has to be established. Otherwise, one simply cannot go through the ordeal. So do we understand then this work of character building, the imposing of the higher vibration on the lower is character building? And we've said it before, the higher vibration is virtue, and the lower vibration is vice. It couldn't be easier to understand. It couldn't be more fundamental, and it requires a great deal of honesty on our part. Now, there's a lot of people out there who are going to tell you about your virtues and your vices, but these have to be seen by ourselves. And then we can take the proper action and move forward. Otherwise, we are held by vice. All right. So there are nine of these, and you know, I'm pretty sure, obviously, we're not going to get through them in this particular program. Already, this is the 12th program on the fifth rule, and when we get to rule number 10, which is 100-something pages long, a lot of programs will be expended on that 10th rule. Right motive. The master of the wisdom, we are told, is the rare efflorescence of a generation of inquirers. Notice how it's spelled in English and differently in American English. And the flowering efflorescence is a flowering of a generation of those who are inquiring the way, asking themselves, their higher self, their inner resources for the answers to the major questions and asking for right direction on the path. It all comes from within. Of course, we ask other people as well for their good advice, but finally, the real directing of ourselves forward, just like the real building of the Antikorana, is an internal process, and we have to do it in our own unique way. The question which the seeker now asks, and which he has only the right, which he only has the right to answer, or which he only has the right to answer, is, all right, what is the motive governing my aspiration and my endeavor? Why do I seek to build the true foundation? Why do I so diligently invoke my soul? Why do I do this? And I think we will find, as DK tells us, that a certain type of spiritual selfishness has often been responsible for the otherwise good actions that we seem to be taking. We end up in some kind of spiritual group, and you know, we ask, how did we get there? Why did we get there? And he informs us, well, you got here because you're spiritually ambitious, a little spiritually selfish, and you want progress. So, a sobering moment, right? So, right motive, and it has to do with also some of the later rules when we come to the idea of let the magician set his form upon the proper path. There's so much here about the discrimination between the left-hand path and the right-hand path, and obviously as white magicians in training, we are seeking to tread the right-hand path. The development of our right motive is a progressive effort. Let's just say why, because often mixed motives prevail. And constantly one shifts the focus of one's incentive when one discovers himself. As the light shines ever more steadily upon one's way, and constantly a newer and higher motive emerges. Each one sees and knows the villainy of each. And let's just say the villainy of ourselves emerges. Things we did not suspect of ourselves. I'm remembering there was a man who was really working hard in Alice Bailey's group, and he did leave the group because he fell in love, and DK called it the greatest of all glamours, my brother, falling in love. Anyway, he left the group. You know, he couldn't quite balance these things of his new relationship and the old continuation of his participation in the group. And eventually he came back, you know, sadder but wiser. And DK basically said, look, I'm sure it's been interesting for you as you learned a lot about yourself, which you did not suspect. I'm paraphrasing what DK actually said there, but you learned a lot, you know. Yeah, there were things about your nature you didn't realize, and being in this new situation, the revelation came to you. The light shone up first upon your character, and then later, once you solved those issues, it would shine upon the part within the divine plan that you could carry out. So, again, let me illustrate. These are very practical examples. An aspirant in the early stages is practically always a devotee. You know, there's a lot of sixth ray that we have been using, and just think of it. I mean, we've been involved the last 2,000 years or so in the age of Pisces, and one of the major rays there is the sixth ray, and we're still in a great sixth ray cycle, even though we're transiting out of a more minor sixth ray cycle at this time. Lots of sixth ray to influence us, plus the general tendency of turning one's aspiration, one's desire, into aspiration and devotion, as we want to rise. So an aspirant in the early stages is practically always a devotee. To measure up to the standard set by a loved friend and teacher, he struggles and strives and gains ground. And isn't this interesting? Because a loved friend, who is a master, really, I mean, a master is a loved friend, is what I want to say. we try to emulate the example set before us. You know, and this is set forward perhaps most momentously in the book called The Imitation of Christ, which comes highly recommended by Master Moria. Not the worship of Christ, no, but the imitation of Christ, the Christ, the beloved friend. Later, the object of his devotion and ardent effort is superseded by devotion to one of the great ones, the elder brothers of the rays, and DK ought to know. He does share with us, Master DK does share with us his great devotion to the Master KH. And that was a devotion which actually, according to the stories he tells, and those stories are very helpful, got him in a little trouble when he was, quote, a young man, which is telling us something about his status. Probably he was a second degree initiate or thereabouts. He bends all his powers and the forces of his nature to their service, the service of the great ones. There was one disciple, ISGL. He says, look, your real orientation is more towards us than it is towards those you serve. He loved the hierarchy, you know, and thought always of the hierarchy. But maybe that was hiding some kind of thought of more rapid advancement rather than the spontaneous service of the loving heart. He was becoming a second-ray soul and was meant to go in that direction. The incentive is in its turn. This incentive is in its turn, surely and steadily superseded by a vital love for humanity. So first the love of hierarchy, understood, but then something wider and broader, the vital love, you know, a living love. This is the Christ consciousness. And the love of one individual, be he ever so perfect, is lost sight of in love for the whole brotherhood of men, of human beings. So this is a recognized, a recognized and a frequent sequence. And, you know, many go through that, from the beloved individual to the masters, and from that perfect master to humanity as a whole, which is what the masters would hope to see in a human being who was attempting to follow in their footsteps. Unceasingly, as the soul takes more and more control of its instrument, and the soul nature steadily manifests through soul infusion, this too is superseded by love of the ideal of the plan, and of the purpose underlying the universe itself. So even beyond the group, even beyond any group such as humanity, is the love of the great ideal arrangement of all things in perfect relationship, which is what plan and purpose, when divine, represent. So this is how it goes. This is the sequence, and you can evaluate where you are in this sequence and whether you are perhaps living through a couple or three stages simultaneously. The man comes to know himself as naught but a channel through which spiritual agencies can work, and realizes himself as the corporate part, a corporate part of the one life. So that is lying ahead of us in its fullness, I venture to say. We begin to love the all beings as part of the expressions of the one life, externalizations of the one life, as Master Dike tells us, when dealing with the quality of harmlessness, the expression of the life of the man who realizes himself to be everywhere, who lives consciously as a soul, whose nature is love, whose method is inclusiveness, and for whom all forms are alike in that they veil and hide the light and are but externalizations of the one infinite being. So we're loving everything, and but especially in our more local planetary sphere, and what the divine plan and purpose can do for the advancement and the increasing glorification of these lives. Then he sees even humanity as relative and fractional, or maybe these days we would say fractal, and becomes immersed in the great will. So he seems to be saying here that eventually our love and devotion, DVD, well, devotion is for the will of God. And what God? Well, it's enough to deal with our own planetary logos, let's say, in his projection of Sanat Kumara and eventually the solar logos. These are the local gods, you know. So this is, we've just been given a very important progression. A very important progression has been given here. Aim, let's just say the nature of devotion and love, or let's say the objects, let's call it that, objects of devotion and love continue to be elevated from a beloved individual, as it is said, to a great exemplar, such as a member of the Brotherhood, to humanity then as a whole, and to the ideal of the plan and purpose, and eventually to the will of God. So you can begin to imagine Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane expressing that love of the will of God. Not my will, but thine be done. Father, not mine will, but thine be done. Being absorbed into the divine will, which even seems in a way to be beyond what we normally call plan or even purpose. So what do we have here, really? Individual, exemplar, humanity, Humanity and the Brotherhood of Men. Plan. Let me change that to divine plan, divine purpose, and finally, the will of God, whichever God it is. Keep it capital. It may be. All right, so that is the question of what motivates us. Now, obviously, when things are going correctly, we are very far, you know, very far from any temptation to tread the path of selfishness. And there are, you know, many people who are tending toward that path. They may not realize it, of course. They think it's the most natural thing in the world, and it has a lot to do with the third ray, which is a major ray of selfishness, being out of proportional development with the second ray. And you know, that's kind of interesting, because he tells us that for the first ray monadic type of human being, love is the most difficult to develop. Now, let's look at our planetary logos. Fortunately, our logos does have a second ray soul, but our planetary logos is a first ray monad, and according to the nature of the monadic ray comes the development in time of the three divine aspects. So probably there's a compensation there because of the second ray soul, and our planetary logos probably can develop love more rapidly than if he were simply a first ray monad without a second ray soul. So, you know, the imbalances here on our earth have something to do with the nature of our planetary logos. It's the only logos whose vehicles, periodical vehicles, namely the monad, soul, and personality, number 1, 2, and 3. Easy as 1, 2, 3, and then we have the cross, since we're fourth in line given Vulcan's presence, fourth from the sun. We're really a 1, 2, 3, and 4. And maybe the 5, well, we're supposed to produce light, a great light demonstration on this planet. Obviously, every planetary logos has all the rays. All right. Service. I think I have time, maybe, for one other discussion here. Let's see how long. Yeah, looks like we have time for that. I'm violating one of my rules here. I try not to, you know, sometimes in order to really save time, I made 5-hour programs, just straight through, blitz. But then our transcribers, seeing such things, didn't even want to start, and I don't blame them. So I've tried to confine my programs to 1 hour these days. However, given the exigencies of today's requirements, I had to move a little beyond the hour. So, service. A study of right motive leads naturally to right service. Let's just say, you know, what can we call it? You know, helping in the right way, not simply in an imitation of service. So it leads to right service, and often parallels it in its objective form, and often parallels in its objective form the motivating consciousness. So, you know, what do we consider our service to be? What do we consider service really to be in esoteric psychology too, there's a whole development of the idea of service, and it's so often not what we think. It's some spontaneous outflow of our soul nature, really through our personality nature, and not so much running around and doing things, you know. Although that can be important too. From service to an individual as an expression of love to the family or to the nation, there grows the service of humanity to a member of the hierarchy, to a master's group, and thence service to humanity. Well, this is the thing that we, you know, it's a question, and everyone has to submit themselves to it. Do I really love humanity? Do I really? Well, you know, it's a platitude, and we talk about it all the time. And we certainly love certain individuals. But if love thine enemy is somehow followed a bit, and we understand it, then it's possible to love humanity filled with many individuals who are not necessarily attractive to us. In fact, matter of fact, they may be repellent to us or dangerous to us or abhorrent to us and so forth. We have to strip away the outer configurations and find the soul within and the spirit within. Eventually, there is developed a consciousness of and service of the plan, not so much of individuals per se, or even of a member of the hierarchy, let's just say the service of the plan is higher than service of a member of the hierarchy. And that may seem a strange thing, but always the hierarchs are attempting to reorient us to the love of humanity from whence the true service comes, and not some kind of glorification of an idealized hierarchical figure whom we want to serve for motives which we must examine. So, eventually there is developed a consciousness of and service of the plan, and I suppose purpose will come into that later, and a consecration to the underlying purpose, there it is, of the great existence who has brought all into being for the fulfillment of some specific objective. So this would be, at first, be the planetary logos, and if our grasp is great enough, it will be the solar logos eventually. So what is the sequence here? Service to the individual, from the individual to the family, to the nation, to the, and in here, of course, these are groups, and one's group comes into this. Some people consider the nation one's group. To a member of hierarchy, to a master's group, and to humanity as a whole. And eventually to the divine plan and purpose. Well, we can see that these two go together. The what is our motive and what is the service arising from that motive. Now, let us examine ourselves and see whom it may be or what it is that we serve and why we serve. You know, what is the orientation there? And have we finally developed this great love of the plan, love and devotion to the plan, which leads to service of the plan? Devotion, love, service. Another sequence let's look at it, is devotion, love, service. So let every one of us evaluate and see to what or to whom are we devoted, what or whom do we love, whom or what, and whom or what do we serve. And I think it would be a very interesting self-examination. Okay, friends, well, I've added an extra half hour on this program. So this is going to be the end of a treatise on white magic video commentary number 512. Oh, video commentary what? Oh, I have to go back, don't I? I always do this. There's got to be a better way. It's going to be number 47, and I think it goes as far as 203. I may have to come back. And it's rule 512. So it's number 47 and 512. Now I'll go back to where I came from. Boring and repetitive. Okay, so, rule 512, and it's video commentary number 47. 512, and what page are we on? From 199 to 204. All right, I'll have to go back. So, page 199 to 204. And the next will be beginning this will be beginning of a treatise on white magic video commentary number 48, and it will be rule 513, and this is going to be about the one we've just done, is approximately 1.5 hours. Okay, and we don't know how long the next one will be. So this is 513. And starting from page 204 and going backwards, I could entertain you with a little singing here, you know. 204. All right, good. All right. That's all I dare do now because of the webinar coming up. And, but we still have these 9 considerations which are foundational to any true spiritual approach. So thank you. And we'll resume when possible with commentary number 48. Okay, all the best, and let's assimilate and apply as the master suggests, because if we do or did, we know where we would be standing, and it would be much farther along than where we are standing now. Okay, see you soon. Bye-bye.